This is a summary of Daring Greatly by bestbookbriefings.com. Daring Greatly. How the courage to be vulnerable transforms the way we live, love, parent, and lead. By Breen Brown. Introduction: My adventures in the arena. Vulnerability is excruciating and exquisite. The author recounts her struggles with vulnerability, first by unpacking how her upbringing as a fifth-generation Texan raised her to try and avoid it at all costs. She tried various personalities and strategies, all with the aim of keeping everybody at a safe distance. In her late 20s, she quit her management job and studied to become a social worker. She learned that social work wasn't really about fixing people, but about leaning into people's uncertainty and creating a space of empathy that they can find their own way in life, a messy task, to be sure. As she struggled to understand this, she discovered the comforts of research, measuring and controlling instead of leaning in. For her research, she studied how human connections worked, but her field of study was inadvertently shifted when, in studying important relationships, her research participants kept telling her about their heartbreaks and shame. She then spent 6 years developing a theory about shame. In doing so, she realized that she had also had to study the opposite of shame of people who were resilient to shame and believed in their own worth. She called them the wholehearted. Through her studies, she defined 10 guideposts for wholehearted living, only to realize that she herself only fulfilled 2 out of the 10. This realization devastated her, and it led to her realizing that vulnerability, the thing she'd been avoiding her entire life, was at the core of being able to form meaningful human connections and experiences. The thing wholehearted people had in common the most was their willingness to be vulnerable. This was a major dilemma for the author. How can you talk about the importance of vulnerability honestly without being vulnerable yourself? However, can you be vulnerable while still being a legitimate researcher? Early in her education, she was taught that keeping a distance and being inaccessible was important for becoming a good academic. On June 10, her moment to dare greatly, as Theodore Roosevelt once encouraged his people to be, would come. The author was invited to speak at TEDx Houston, an independently organized event devoted to sharing ideas worth spreading. Despite her misgivings, she gave a talk on the topic of vulnerability, not knowing that it would go viral and become one of the most viewed videos on TED.com. Its popularity would lead her to go around the country giving talks to big companies, school districts, and parents, giving her the opportunity to share her life's work on the subject. She realized that no matter where she went, the core issues were always the same: fear and disengagement. Her experiences would lead her to write this book. 1. Scarcity: Looking Inside Our Culture of Ain't Never Enough. Narcissism is a major problem with people today. Or is it? The term is certainly used a lot in modern vocabulary, a convenient catch-all term for people who are arrogant and rude and everything in between. It can feel like we're surrounded by narcissists, that our culture has turned into one that's self-absorbed, entitled, and obsessed with power, success, and beauty. This is exactly the problem, you might think. Not with me, of course, but generally, yes. It can feel good to have an explanation that also makes us feel better about ourselves. Our first instinct might be to cure narcissists by cutting them down and telling them that they need to get over themselves. However, the problem is that almost no one understands that many of the characteristics of narcissism stems from shame. It's more likely to be the cause, not the cure. Diagnosing and labeling people doesn't help to heal them. More often than not, the problem is not with who the person is, but with the choices they make and the environment they're in. It doesn't mean they aren't responsible for their actions, but it does mean we should take a closer look at the root of their problems. The author finds it very helpful to look at behaviors like these through the lens of vulnerability. In the case of narcissism, she sees the shame-based fear of being ordinary, of never being special enough to be loved, or to belong. This new definition illuminates the source of the problem of cultural messaging that says an ordinary life is a meaningless life. Kids grow up on a diet of reality TV, celebrity culture, and social media that teach them they are only as good as the number of likes they get. Because we are all vulnerable to this type of messaging, this definition takes away the us versus them element in understanding narcissism. Everyone wants to believe that what they do matters. When you feel the pain of being too ordinary and inadequate, it's easy to reach for entitlement and seek admiration as a solution, even if it's not a healthy one. Something can always be learned when asked these questions. 1. What are my culture's expectations, and how does it influence my behavior? 2. How is our behavior related to protecting ourselves? 3. How are our thoughts, emotions, and behavior related to vulnerability and the need for worthiness? The author does not believe that we're surrounded by narcissists. She thinks it goes deeper than that. There is a cultural influence at play here, our culture of scarcity. In her work, the author finds that certain reactions show if her studies resonate with her participants. Namely, people looking away, covering their faces with their hands, responding with "ouch," or "get out of my head." This comes up a lot when they are shown the phrase, "never enough." It only takes a few seconds for people to fill the blanks in with their own insecurities. Never good enough. Never thin enough. Never smart enough. Never certain enough. And so on. Scarcity is the never enough problem, and we understand the concept because we live it every day. In Lynn Twist's book The Soul of Money, she writes about scarcity as the great lie. We wake up in the morning, and the first thing we think is, I didn't get enough sleep. Next, we'll think, I don't have enough time. Whether it's true or not, the thought of a not enough comes to us automatically, and we spend most of our waking hours hearing, complaining, and worrying about what we have, and what we don't have enough of. We're constantly assessing and comparing our lives to unattainable standards, or to what we think other people's lives are like. This change didn't happen overnight, but the author has observed major shifts in her country's culture. The past 2 decades have been traumatic for so many people that it's changed things. From 9/11, to wars, to natural disasters, our sense of safety has been torn away from us so forcefully that even if we weren't directly involved, we've experienced them as trauma. Worrying about scarcity is a cultural version of post-traumatic stress. When we've been through too much, we get angry and scared, instead of coming together to heal, which requires vulnerability. This affects us on all levels, from family culture, to work culture, to school, and community. They all share the same formula of shame, comparison, and disengagement. Apply these criteria to your current situation. 1. Shame, is the fear of ridicule used to manage people? Is self-worth tied to achievement and productivity? Is blaming and name-calling common? 2. Comparison, are people held to one standard instead of acknowledged for their unique contributions? Is there an ideal that is being used to measure everyone? 3. Disengagement, are people afraid to take risks? Is it easier to stay quiet than to share experiences? Does it feel like no one is really paying attention, but everyone is struggling to be seen? Fighting these things takes awareness, commitment, and work on a daily basis. The solution to scarcity is not abundance, the opposite of never enough isn't more than you could imagine. It's enough, or what the author calls wholeheartedness, an approach that has vulnerability and worthiness at its core. These are the things that a scarcity culture snuffs out. 2. Debunking the vulnerability myths. Myth 1, vulnerability is weakness. This is the most widely accepted myth, and the most dangerous. When we spend our lives avoiding vulnerability, we can feel contempt when others are less capable or willing to hide their emotions, to suck it up, and soldier on. Instead of respecting their courage, we judge and criticize them. Our rejection of vulnerability comes from us associating it with dark emotions like fear, shame, and disappointment. However, vulnerability isn't good or bad, it's simply the core of all our emotions, not only of dark emotions, but also of love, courage, empathy, and creativity. To believe vulnerability is weakness is to believe that feeling it all is weakness, closing us off from our emotional life. Vulnerability can be a paradox. We love seeing the raw truth in other people, but we're afraid that our truth isn't enough. What is courage for them becomes inadequacy in you. Vulnerability is a risk, life asking, are you all in? Answering yes is not weakness, it's daring greatly. Myth 2, I don't do vulnerability. It's a phrase the authors heard so many times, and said just as often. However, no one is exempt from vulnerability, uncertainty, and risk, no matter their gender, position, or status. To live is to be vulnerable. It helps to ask someone we are close to what we're like when we feel exposed or uncomfortable. The answers will show that regardless of whether you feel like you don't do vulnerability, you'll find that vulnerability still does you. Experiencing vulnerability isn't a choice, the choice is in how we respond when we're confronted with it. And choosing to decide still means that you've made a choice. Myth number 3, vulnerability is letting it all hang out. Vulnerability is about mutual openness. It's not oversharing, or purging, or dumping information on someone. We can't always have a guarantee when we share something, but we also don't bare our souls to people we've only met. Vulnerability without boundaries can actually lead to disconnection and distrust. In fact, giving too much information is one way we protect ourselves from actually being vulnerable. Myth 4, we can go alone. Individualism is a value we hold in high esteem, but we can't be vulnerable by ourselves. We need support, people who will let us be who we are without judging us. Many of us are good at giving help, but we need to be able to ask for help, too. In the author's book The Gifts of Imperfection, she writes that, until we can receive with an open heart, we are never really giving with an open heart. In fact, research shows that not only is asking for support critical to success, it can also be contagious. Having leaders who acknowledge their failings and ask for help transforms their organizations for the better. 3. Understanding and combating shame. We all experience shame, and we're all afraid to talk about it. The less we talk about it, the more of it we have. If we want to dare greatly, if we want more courage, we have to learn how to be vulnerable. The author gives an example. Say you've made something that you want to share with a group of friends. However, you've attached your self-worth to how your work is received. If they love it, you're worthy. If not, you're worthless. If your work fails, shame tells you you're not good enough and that you shouldn't even have tried. It's even worse if your work succeeds. You hand over your self-worth to what people think. Once it takes off the ground, you become a prisoner to pleasing others. With a strong awareness and resilience towards shame, this scenario turns out differently. You still want people to admire what you've created, but your self-worth is not on the table. Yes, it'll be disappointing if your colleagues and friends don't care as much as you do, but the work is about what you do, not what you are. When we don't risk our self-worth, we are much more willing to be courageous and share our talents and gifts. A sense of worthiness encourages us to share openly and to innovate. We can never be fully shame-resistant. As long as we care about connecting, the fear of being disconnected from others will always be a powerful force. However, we can learn shame resilience, being able to face shame authentically, move through without losing our values, and come out the other side with more courage than we had going into it, being able to move from shame to empathy, which is the real antidote to shame. The author lists 4 steps we can take to practice shame resilience. 1. Recognizing shame. Can you recognize when you're having a shame attack, get through it, and figure out what triggered it? 2. Critical awareness. Can your reality check the messages that trigger your shame? Are they attainable? Are they what you want to be, or what you think others want from you? 3. Reaching out. Are you owning your story and sharing it with others? 4. Speaking shame. Are you talking about how you feel and asking for what you need? Shame resilience also requires thinking, but that's where shame has a huge advantage. When we feel the pain of shame, we are hijacked by our flight or fight response, a physical response that is more effective for survival, not for connecting with others. Influenced by this, some of us deal with shame by moving away, hiding, silencing ourselves, and keeping secrets. Some of us move toward, looking to please. Some of us move against, being aggressive and trying to gain power over others, often by using shame to fight shame. Unfortunately, all of these strategies move us away from connection, they're all to disconnect us from the pain. 4. The vulnerability armory. Masks and armor are perfect metaphors for how we protect ourselves from vulnerability. Masks make us feel safe, even when they suffocate. Armor makes us feel stronger, even when we get tired of carrying the extra weight. Everyone has a persona. As children, we try different ways to hide our fear and self-doubt. As you get older, it can become like a second skin, indistinguishable from the actual person. Many adults express a fear of taking their mask off as no one knows what they're really like, not even themselves. Although we each have a unique set of protection mechanisms, swapping them in and out depending on our circumstances, we all share a few common ones. It is the author's hope that studying these will help us to know ourselves better, and hopefully learn to put our armor away. 1. Foreboding joy. The author argues that joy is the most difficult emotion to feel. In a culture of deep scarcity, never feeling safe or certain enough, joy can feel like a setup. We wake up and think work is going well. Family's healthy. There's no major crisis, this is bad. Something bad must be right around the corner. Even though the world is much safer in many ways than it used to be, the stakes feel so much higher. We have more knowledge, and therefore more ways to imagine bad things happening, a terrorist attack, a natural disaster, a pandemic. The mentality is that expecting the worst prepares for it, or that it's easier to live in disappointment than it is to be disappointed. We don't want to be shocked by pain, so we practice it instead. Unfortunately, this rarely helps, and all it does is stop us from feeling joy while it's present. 2. Perfectionism. In all the years of the author's research, not once has she ever heard a person attribute their joy, success, or wholeheartedness to being perfect. Perfectionism is not the same thing as striving for excellence. It's a defensive move, the belief that if we do things perfectly, we can avoid the pain of blame and judgment. Perfectionism isn't about self-improvement, it's about trying to earn approval, and it hampers actual achievement. It's not a way to avoid shame, it is shame. 3. Numbing. This mechanism is about addiction, but it applies to all of us. One of the most common numbing strategies is to stay what the author calls crazy busy, filling your life with enough work and responsibility that you won't have time to think about how you feel. Numbing can also refer to doing illegal drugs, or even just having a few glasses of wine after work. It can be the sugar, the fantasy football, all things we do every day. This powerful need for numbing seems to stem from a combination of three things: shame, anxiety, and disconnection. 5. Mind the gap, cultivating change and closing the disengagement divide. There's an ongoing debate in the business world about the relationship between strategy and culture, and how important each of them is. As a definition, strategy is a game plan, an answer to the question, what do we want to achieve, and how do we do it? Culture, however, is less about what we want to do, and more about who we are. As Terence Deal and Alan Kennedy explained, culture is the way we do things around here. You can tell a lot about the culture and values of an organization by asking these questions. 1. What behaviors are rewarded or punished? 2. Where and how are people actually spending their time, money, and attention? 3. What happens when someone fails or disappoints? 1. How is vulnerability perceived? How prevalent is shame and blame? Taking time to think on these can reveal the values we actually practice, instead of the ones we aspire to. In other words, it shows if we're really walking our talk. If not, disengagement, the author theorizes, is the issue behind a lot of the problems they see in families, schools, and organizations. We disengage to protect ourselves from vulnerability and shame. We also disengage when we feel like our leaders aren't living up to their end of the social contract. Politics is an appropriate and painful example of this. Politicians make laws that don't affect them, and they behave in ways that should normally result in getting fired or even arrested. They claim values that they rarely have, and watching them fight amongst themselves is degrading and demoralizing for us. Voter turnout statistics show that we're disengaging. We don't intentionally create cultures that encourage disengagement, so how does it happen? Where's the gap? It's here. We can't give people what we don't have. Who we are, then, matters much more than what we know or want to be. The space between our practiced values and our aspirational values is where we lose our employees, our students, and even our children. Here are some common examples in families. 1. Aspirational honesty and integrity. Practiced, rationalizing and letting things slide. Mom always tells her kids that honesty and integrity are important, but as they get into the car after a trip to the grocery, she realizes that the cashier didn't charge her for the sodas. Instead of going back to pay for them, she shrugs and says, "It wasn't my fault." 2. Aspirational, respect and accountability practiced, fast and easy are more important. Dad always teaches the importance of respect and accountability, but when Bobby breaks Sammy's new toy on purpose, Dad is too busy on his phone to sit down and talk with them about it. He shrugs and thinks boys will be boys. 3. Aspirational, gratitude and respect practiced, teasing, taking for granted. Mom and Dad always feel underappreciated, and they're tired of their kids always disrespecting them. But they yell and call each other names. No one says please or thank you, including them. The author wants to stress that these examples are all based on real-life data. We can't be perfect role models all of the time, of course, but when our practiced values regularly conflict with the expectations we set for each other, disengagement is going to be inevitable. Minding the gap is a daring strategy. It requires us to practice the values we hold as important. It requires us to embrace our own vulnerability, as we're called to be leaders in new and uncomfortable ways. We don't have to be perfect, just engaged and committed to aligning our values with our actions. 6. Disruptive engagement, daring to rehumanize education and work. In her research work with entrepreneurs and students, the author realized that they both faced a common obstacle to learning. In the words of a middle schooler she interviewed, "If you've got a teacher that doesn't like you asking questions, or kids in the class make fun of it, then most of us learn that it's best to keep your head down and your mouth shut." Given this, and what the author has observed as she's worked with leaders of all sorts and sizes, she believes that we have to completely overhaul our concept of engagement. She calls it disruptive engagement. We can start by recognizing and combating shame. Blaming, gossiping, and harassment are all clues that there is shame in a particular culture. Sometimes, it's even outright used as a tool for managing people, leaders bullying their members, publicly scolding them, or setting up reward systems designed to belittle and humiliate. No organization is shame-free. In fact, a few people have come up to the author to proudly state that they use shame on a daily basis, and it gets results. 85% of the participants in the author's shame study could recall an incident in school that was shaming. It changed the way they saw themselves, with almost half of them recounting how it stopped them from pursuing creative endeavors. A poll conducted in 2010 reported that 54 million American workers have been bullied at work. Half of the time, workers reported that employers did nothing to stop it. When we see shame being used as a tool, we need to take direct action before it spreads, passing the same on to customers, students, and families. Shame can only be used for so long before people disengage to protect themselves. In a shame-saturated culture, blame will often be following right behind. Jun Tangney and Rhonda Deering explain that in the face of any negative outcome, someone or something must be found responsible. After all, if someone is to blame and it isn't me, it must be you. Blame is the discharging of pain, simple as that. It isn't productive. In relation to blame is the issue of cover-ups. Cover-up cultures rely on shame to keep people quiet. When an organization shows that it's more important to protect its own reputation and those in power above the basic human dignity of people, you're sure to find that shame goes all the way to the bone, to the very system of things. If you look at any major incidents around cover-ups, you'll see this. This doesn't work as a management style. You can't lead by fear. The author interviewed Gay Gaddis, the owner and founder of the Think Tank, America's largest woman-owned advertising agency. She had this to say about, "When you shut down vulnerability, you shut down opportunity." Entrepreneurship by definition is vulnerable. It's about the ability to handle and manage uncertainty. You have to create a vision and live up to it, and there is no vision without vulnerability. Success requires strong support networks and good networks, so you can shut out the noise and get to work. In Seth Godin's book Tribes, We Need You to Lead Us, he writes, "Leadership is scarce because few people are willing to go through the discomfort required to lead. It's uncomfortable to stand up in front of strangers. It's uncomfortable to propose an idea that might fail. When you identify the discomfort, you've found the place where a leader is needed." 7. Wholehearted parenting, daring to be the adults we want our children to be. Many parents would love a handbook, a list of certain rules and methods they can follow to raise safe, happy, and successful children. The need for certainty in a job as uncertain as parenthood makes absolute how-to-parent strategies seductive and dangerous. It's dangerous because certainty often leads to intolerance and judgment. Parents can be critical of each other because they latch onto a method, and their way can quickly become the way. If another parent makes different choices, they can often see it as a direct criticism of the way they parent. As a result, parenting is a minefield of shame and judgment. We rarely engage in judging others when we're confident in our own decisions, after all. Buried inside our hopes for our children is the truth that there is no such thing as a perfect parent. All the discussion around it can often distract us from the important truth that who we are and how we engage with the world is a stronger influence on our children than what we know about parenting. Parents have much less control than they would like to have over things like personality and emotion, much less over the scarcity culture. But the opportunity to parent lies in how they help their children to be resilient in the face of a never enough. The question isn't, are you parenting the right way? As it is, are you the adult that you want your child to grow up to be? Even though being vulnerable as a parent can be terrifying, it is also the best place for a parent to teach connection, meaning, and love. If we push vulnerability away, we turn parenting into a competition, who knows more, who's better. But if we put all the standards aside, most of us can agree that what we really want for our children is to be able to live and love with their whole hearts. If we want to do this, we can't use fear, shame, and judgment in their lives, or ours. If we want children who love and accept who they are, our job is to love and accept who we are. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.